Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee meeting to order. Members, if you could please take your seats. We do have a quorum present. Before we begin our agenda today, I'd like to go through a few housekeeping items for our hearing today and for our hearings in the future. I'd like to remind everyone in the audience to please be seated when they are in the hearing room. It's important that we also keep space off to the side because it's not unusual that we have people who are disabled who need to use space in the aisles for how they arrive here. We also want to make sure that we don't permit any signs while we have anything going on in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. If there are any signs, we ask that they be please left outside the hearing room. And finally, of all the testifiers who have signed up in advance, who have provided time to testify, I reserve the right as the chair of the committee to impose a time limit on comments. Today is going to be one of those days where we've got a number of bills, so we're going to be limiting time on comments. And this is to make sure that we can meet, get all our work done in the time that we have available, and to hear as many people as possible. I will usually ask the room if there are further testifiers who would like to speak, but that may not always be possible. I want to thank everyone for your understanding and adhering to these rules. Our first action item is approval of the minutes. We have our minutes from Monday, February 26. Who would like to move? Representative Ingen moves the minutes from February 26. Are there any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from February 26th, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries, and the minutes from February 26th are approved. Our first bill on the agenda today is House File 3483. I'd like to welcome Representative Feist to our committee. Thank you for being here. We will be voting on this by 2:30 so that we can keep on the agenda for our other items that we have today. Representative Feist, seeing you are not a member of the committee, I will move to refer House File 3483 to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Feist, I understand that you have an author's amendment. I will move your author's A2 amendment. Would you please explain it to us?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A2 amendment is a reflection on a great conversation I had with folks who have expressed some concerns with this bill. Those conversations are ongoing, but for now I wanted to make these three changes. We deleted a cross-reference that would have created some liability relating to acts by third parties. We just clarified some language, changed known to knowing because it's more clear. And we deleted one of the three prongs for potential liability because that liability resides elsewhere in the law. So those are the three changes in this A2 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Members, any questions or comments on the A2 author's amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 author's amendment to House File 3483 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion is approved and the author's A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Feist, if you'd like to introduce your bill as amended, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. The heart of House File 3483 is to protect the rights of the 35,000 Minnesotans subject to guardianship who are among the most vulnerable residents in our state. At the outset, I would like to say that I had an excellent meeting this week with representatives of professional guardians who have expressed concerns with the language as originally introduced. Based on these conversations, I introduced the amendment that we just passed just now, and we're in the process of discussing two additional adjustments that I believe we are close to agreement on final language. So I'm looking forward to those ongoing discussions, and I appreciate everyone's participation in the conversation. This bill is urgent. It corrects confusing statutory language related to immunity for guardians that was created by a 2022 Minnesota Court of Appeals case that held that a guardian receives blanket immunity for any acts in the provision of care, such as providing no food, no water, and even proactively harming an individual leading to their death. Most states have little or no immunity for guardians. Minnesota is believed to be the only state to now have blanket immunity. Some key points to understand about this bill. Stakeholder meetings have included attorneys, professional and private guardians, DHS, organizations, and individuals representing the interests of guardians and people under guardianship, as well as disability and elder rights organizations. These parties have been continuously meeting to address the gap in the law created by the Zika decision. Even those who would like us to take a slower path to consensus have participated in the deliberation or been invited to do so. Importantly, even those who have expressed concerns with the original language have told me that there is not a single person who does not agree that the statutory language around guardianship liability needs to be updated. This bill is based on the model that is found in numerous other states where there is limited immunity from liability. This is not a novel legal construct that will place Minnesota's guardians in a uniquely vulnerable legal position. The only guardians who need to be worried about this law ensuring accountability for egregious behavior are guardians who should not be guardians. The significant majority of guardianships in Minnesota are private guardianships. These are family members caring for a loved one. They do not search Westlaw to make sure they understand the case law before deciding whether to care for their parent, sibling, or child. Minnesota does not have a history of bringing liability claims for guardians for their care functions. Guardians and attorneys have operated for many decades on the assumption of some liability for reckless and illegal behavior in their role as guardians. There is no reason to expect a flurry of new cases, especially when the recourse for misbehavior by a guardian is typically simply removing that guardian. As we discuss the bill, we need to center the needs of people under guardianship in this conversation. We are about to have a discussion about abstract legal standards and guardians' interests, but at the end of the day, we need to remember that the current status of the law does not adequately protect Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. These are the Minnesotans who are least able to advocate for themselves here at the Capitol and in their own homes, and we need to center them in this discussion. So I will leave it now to my presenters and also just refer members of the committee to the materials that were submitted. Some very powerful letters were submitted to you. And again, I just want to emphasize that conversations have been really productive, so I appreciate everyone coming to the table. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Feist. We will go to our first testifier, Ann Murray. If you'd like to come forward, please. And reminding people that we have a two-minute time for each person that is testifying. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Ann Murray. And good afternoon, Chair Fisher and Representative Peel, members of the House Human Services Committee, Policy Committee. I'm a little nervous, so cut me off at 2 minutes. I'm here to speak on behalf of my grown daughter and her peers who are also under guardianship. Several years ago, after a disagreement with the local social services agency, a petition was filed accusing me of maltreatment and nominating a successor guardian. That's how we got here. The disagreement was over whether or not we could use some waivered monies to put a lift in the stairway for her safety. Eventually, the court issued its ruling and said that I didn't maltreat her, but they placed her in a group home, the court did, under guardianship because the second floor of our house was not ADA compliant in our private home. Initially, I was allowed to visit with her by phone in my person. But when things would happen and I would tell the guardian about things that would happen, like isolation or being refused a meal or something on that order, it wasn't me that was punished, it was my daughter. She didn't get to go on the same trips to Dairy Queen or shopping trips, things like that. Eventually, our phone calls were blocked. Our visits were denied at the doorway, and at one point I was accused of violating the restrictions, and a maltreatment report was filed, which was also reversed. But it took two trips to the maltreatment review board to do that, and I don't know that all the parents have the time or initiative to fight like that. Anyway, the last few years have been a little quieter The guardian, however, files their papers without signing them and doesn't send the annual reports to us or any of the other documents that we need to have in order to finish. I just want to say that people need one another. We need each other along the way. None of us got here where we are by ourselves. We all had help. A guardian does that. A guardian helps protect the interests of somebody. And people deserve to have that person held accountable. Thank you for hearing my testimony and for inviting me here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here to testify. Our next testifier is Emily Wischeil, and I apologize if I mispronounced your name. Thank you for taking the time to come down here today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members. My name is Emily Wischeil, and I'm an attorney with Hennepin County Adult Representation Services, or ARS. My office represents folks that are experiencing poverty and are entitled to representation in civil matters, such as guardianships and conservatorships in Hennepin County. We are unique in the state in that we exclusively represent persons subject to guardianship. We don't represent guardians, family members, or other people interested in those cases. I'm here today because the current interpretation of Minnesota Statute 524.5-313C2 fails to adequately protect the rights and dignity of persons subject to guardianship in Minnesota and leaves our clients without recourse if harm should occur to them while under guardianship. The change proposed in this bill is urgently needed to balance the rights of persons subject to guardianship and the role of the guardian. It's unjust that persons who are subject to guardianship and who have been adjudicated as incapacitated by the court through no fault of their own and often against their will are now subject to restricted civil liberties and currently have less protection and redress for intentional harms. This bill ensures that some of the most vulnerable people in our state are protected and have redress if harm should occur. So for these reasons, I'm requesting that you support the law today, or the bill today. And I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Next testifier I have is Christine Sonnenberg. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for taking the time to be here. If you could please introduce yourself, begin your testimony, and the next person after Christine will be Megan Kelly.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. I'm Chris Sonnenberg, and I'm Executive Director of Elder Voice Advocates. And we are a nonprofit organization whose mission is to assure quality care of elders and to protect the rights of both elders and people living with disabilities. Since our inception in 2017, guardianship abuse has been a frequent problem for many of these vulnerable adults. House File 3483 seeks to balance the rights of the 35,000 persons under guardianship with the important role of the guardian. The Zika case interpreted Minnesota law to grant complete immunity to guardians. This obviously does not protect the vulnerable adult. Under complete immunity, a person cannot be found liable and the case is not heard on its merits. Under qualified immunity, a person is immune from liability except under certain circumstances which are proposed in this bill. In Minnesota, government officials, municipalities, and Good Samaritans, for instance, receive this qualified immunity. The proposed language actually raises the bar from a reasonable to a more restrictive intentional standard. Based on state-by-state research, Minnesota is believed to be the only state with complete immunity. This bill is based in part on an Iowa law which grants immunity to guardians except for breach of fiduciary duty and willful or wanton misconduct. It's important to note that guardians in Minnesota have always been immune from third-party acts. Additionally, guardians in other states are functioning with qualified immunity and even in some cases no immunity. After this court decision, Elder Voice advocates reached out to a broad range of stakeholders and convened a series of meetings beginning in August of last year.
If you could wrap it up, we're at 2 minutes.
I will do so. We've worked hard to hear their concerns. When concerns were expressed, we asked for suggestions. None came. But nonetheless, we believe this bill represents a balance of these competing interests. With that, thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Megan Kelly. You'd like to come forward. And next person, if you could be ready to come down, would be Trevor Turner. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today. If you could please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members of the committee, thank you for the time today. My name is Megan Kelly. I'm an attorney, and I've been representing families and vulnerable adults and guardians in guardianship matters in Minnesota for over 11 years. I'm a frequent presenter and writer on these topics, and I'm here today to express my concerns regarding this bill. First, I want to say that many of my dear friends and colleagues are on the other side of this discussion. We live in a very small sandbox. There aren't very many people who understand guardianship. And so I just want to express appreciation for the conversations we have had, and I do hope that we come to some sort of an agreement here. I do want to express some disagreement with some of the statements that have been made. For example, I disagree that guardians have been granted full immunity in Minnesota. To the contrary, the Zika case focused specifically on 313C2 and focused on the guardian's lack of responsibility for its acts as a guardian. I don't believe that that immunity extends to a person's acts as a caregiver. So, for example, if someone were depriving someone of food, I don't believe that that would be covered under this immunity. So I don't believe that there's a risk that guardians have a license to kill. Guardianship in Minnesota is hanging by a thread from a budget standpoint. We are a grossly underfunded and also vital service to Minnesotans. The average guardian is not paid because the average guardian is a family member. Who is already dealing with the incredibly difficult job of caring for a disabled family member. Those guardians who are paid an average of $35 to $65 an hour, and they are generally limited to around 4 hours per month. What that runs out to is most guardians are paid significantly less than $5,000 per year per person that they serve, if they are paid at all. Guardians are already hard to find in Minnesota. We are already seeing a lack of people entering the field. This is a very important field that keeps the services in Minnesota running. And we already have mechanisms that are underfunded in our courts that can be used to address many of the concerns expressed here today. For example, there is a guardianship complaint line where only one person is thoroughly investigating these complaints. And if we were able to provide additional funding to that, we would have more people providing those services. Again, I want to express appreciation for the conversations that have been had here and to express to the committee and to others here that everyone here cares about vulnerable adults and we want to come to the right conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Thank you for your testimony. If Trevor Turner could then please come down, and after Trevor, I have Lillian Sackett. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. And I'm here to advocate for the passage of House File 3483, which establishes a task force on guardianship reform. Over the years I've served Minnesotans with disabilities, I've heard countless stories of those under guardianship who have faced abuse, neglect, and violation of their basic human rights. And many individuals under guardianship are at risk of exploitation and neglect due to inadequate safeguards and alternative pathways. Guardianship and conservatorship programs are so serious regarding the loss of civil rights and choice for people's own lives that we must be diligent and reevaluate those programs when patterns and issues arise. When I've sat down with constituents and stakeholders who are advocating for guardianship reform, I've asked what needs to be changed, and the answers vary widely. And a task force on guardianship reform is a necessary first step in convening the multitude of stakeholders and advocates to produce a cohesive policy proposal that will update our guardianship system for the 21st century, as well as explore alternatives to guardianship like supported decision making. How can we minimize the loss of rights and protect due process? These are the issues that need robust debate. Additionally, we need to find better pathways for individuals with disabilities to end their guardianship if they wish to do so and is appropriate. Currently, the process for terminating guardianship can be complex and challenging, making it difficult for individuals to regain control over their lives. We need to streamline this process and ensure that individuals have access to necessary resources, knowledge, and support to end their guardianship if they so desire. Finally, the establishment of a task force on guardianship reform is vital to addressing these pressing issues, reforming the guardianship system, and exploring alternatives for Minnesotans with disabilities in our state. I urge you to support House File 3483, and I support the lives of Minnesotans with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Finally, on the list I have, Lillian Sackett, if you'd like to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Lillian Sackett. I am an attorney at Jedelo Snyder Stumis. I've been practicing law for 8 years, and 7 of those have been primarily in the area of guardianships and conservatorships. One thing that I think people are not understanding is that you need professional guardians to accept appointments. There are many different reasons you might need a professional. Perhaps the vulnerable adult has no one left in their life who will help them. Maybe the vulnerable adult is being exploited by their family in any number of ways. These things are not unique. I see them. I see them all the time. I've seen them this month, and I'm sure I'll continue to see them repeatedly throughout the year. But if you subject professional guardians to the kind of widespread liability that this bill would create, they will not accept appointments. I've seen hospitals, care facilities, and even counties, adult protection services, routinely rely on experienced professional guardians to accept appointments. In anticipation and concern about this bill being passed, I've already seen professionals be unwilling to accept new appointments, and it is already impacting our community in a negative way. I've heard today that there's not enough recourse. This is not true. Currently, a MARC report can be filed to have a guardian investigated if they are maltreating a vulnerable adult. You can submit complaints, which are also investigated, and I agree that could use more funding. I think it is valuable and useful. You can seek removal of a guardian, and if a professional is removed, that removal must be reported, and in all other guardianship files they have, it is a very strong deterrent. And you can always challenge the decisions a guardian makes. I've seen that happen too. And so a vulnerable adult does indeed have a voice. They have a right to an attorney. If you pass this bill, then you're going to be harming the most vulnerable people in our community, the people that have no one left to speak for them except for professionals, because they will no longer serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to be here. That is the list of testifiers that I currently have. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, if you could please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi, thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Christine Hollingsworth, and I'm here with Presbyterian Family Foundation. We provide guardianship and conservatorship to approximately 300 folks in Minnesota, and I'll be brief. If this bill passes, there will be a mass exodus of guardians leaving, resigning. You will not find folks to sign up for this. I agree with Lily. There are many arenas of recourse for a person, and I've experienced them all, having been a guardian for approximately 7 years now with PFF. I've seen them all. Not only are there checks and balances in our company, There are checks and balances in the court with DHS and with team meetings. There are many checks and balances, and there are usually outcomes with this that are that the vulnerable person is agreeable to. We have to follow the Bill of Rights. That means the best interest for that person to keep them safe and well, and also hold their choices first. It's a delicate balance. And if this bill passes, you will see a mass exodus of guardians and conservators in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. And Mr. Hughes.
Quickly, I can do it yes. In 30 seconds.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Hi, Mark Hughes. Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Fisher, Spencer, and everyone. I'm a former 12-year member of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities, and I'm just here to stand on record and say that I support Trevor's testimony and the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities on the bill. And I want you to know what an important enhancement is for the lives of people with disabilities. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time, Mr. Hughes. Not seeing any further testifiers, I'd like to turn it over to questions or comments. Representative Keel first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I walked in a little bit late. I apologize. What do you see as the major issues that need to be studied to improve the guardianship in Minnesota? So what are the major issues that we would be studying?
Yep. Representative Feist.
So I think ultimately what we're looking at is ensuring that people can live in the least restrictive environment possible, that they can have the greatest agency in their own lives. And so I'm just going to the task force page, you have in your packets letters from people who have lived under guardianship and have expressed, really significant concerns in terms of how they are able to have autonomy in their lives, the mismanagement of like medication, access to things like whether they should be having soda or it's dangerous for their health, making decisions about where they live. We had our testifier here today talking about how her daughter was moved out of a home where she was, being supported and was safe. So there are obviously a lot of problems with the current system as it exists, and we have 35,000 people in Minnesota who are under guardianship, and I think we should be really thinking about, do we want that many people under guardianship? So the experts can tell you more about the specifics, but I think you've heard like people who are concerned with this bill and support it, I think would both agree that we really do need a task force to like think hard about our guardianship laws.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear what you're saying, and I hear the support and the concerns. I would have the same concerns about 35,000 people. So do we have 35,000 guardians? Or is it all family? Or, how does that happen?
Representative Feist.
So two-thirds of the guardians in the state of Minnesota are private guardians, so generally family, a lot of times parents. One-third of guardians in the state of Minnesota would be professional guardians.
Representative Keel.
Professional guardians.
Yeah.
So they're not making a whole lot of money. I'm guessing they are spending more than 6 hours a month? Or did I catch that wrong?
Representative Feist.
I didn't hear 6 hours a month.
Yeah.
I didn't catch that.
It's got to be a lot more than 6 hours. Maybe I missed that.
It's generally about 4 months.
Excuse me. If we could go through
We had to the go chair. Through the chair. Sorry, yes. Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Yes. So the question is, she could come testify, respond. But how much is spent on as a guardian?
Well, if we could hold on the testifier coming up, reps, and I want to try to keep things moving along too, because we do have other bills here. So quick to Representative Feist, and then I've got Representative Edelson, Hicks, and Coran. One question each when we get to you.
Oh. I think the answer to the question, the larger answer, you have the expert who can hover in the wings, is that people who are professional guardians generally have more than one person under guardianship. And so the money they might make per hour per individual might not sound like a lot. And Representative Hicks can correct me. But my understanding is that professional guardians have many people under their care.
Okay, thank you.
You wanted us to just keep it to one question?
Yeah.
All right. I'll stop.
Thank you, Representative. Yeah, and this is also going to state government after this, so it'll be getting further discussion. I know that more work will be done on this by the time it gets there. Representative Edelson.
One quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to pass it to Representative Hicks if you want to go to her next.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this bill, Representative Feist. So there's a lot of folks who have strong feelings about immunity. There's also a lot of people who don't fully understand the scope of a guardian, what they're able to do or not able to do. It's a very common misconception about what their role is, including sometimes people using that misconception to make choices that are not person-centered and that do not take into account the wishes of the family. I have worked with some amazing professional guardians, and I've worked with some amazing parental guardians. And I have seen the other side, very much like Mr. Turner spoke of. If my guardian, my professional guardian, or my family guardian, doesn't fill out the paperwork I need for my medical assistance, or doesn't help me make sure that I understand a lease, or doesn't do some of those things around care and housing and food that are essential for me to stay on the planet, and I'm under guardianship because I can't do those things independently, and perhaps I don't have the robust support network that people talk about sometimes, not everybody has that, then there are these mechanisms in place. There's the MARC, and there's the complaint line, and all of those things are real. We wouldn't have had a Supreme Court case, though, if all of those things were working perfectly. Immunity implies that there's no responsibility. And when you are being both instructed by a judge and paid to provide guardianship, you are not immune if you make a mistake that hurts someone. Period. We don't give child care providers immunity if they make mistakes. We don't give therapists immunity. We don't give other people who provide care immunity. This is no different, and it should not be treated different. But again, because people have significant disabilities and are seen as being othered, it's okay for those folks to be treated differently. So thank you again for recognizing the humanity in our community and for bringing this forward.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I understand Representative Coran has withdrawn. Representative Ingen, did you have a quick question? And then we'll go to closing comments and voting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. We did hear several testifiers who had expressed that this could really break the system, and they're fearful of that. They're already seeing folks that are no longer wanting to be guardians. It's just really important that we get this right. I want to express that, and I think that there's more work that needs to be had, and I wish we had a little bit more time to deliberate and ask some questions on this bill, but where does that stand with some of those stakeholders that are expressing concern? Have there been some really robust discussions as to how we can strike that proper balance of protecting those vulnerable adults but also protecting those guardians?
Representative Feist.
Thank you for the question. The conversations have been really good. We met for a while. I forget what day it is. It's Wednesday. I met yesterday. Or was it Monday? I don't know. The days here like blend together. But anyway, we met this week, had a really good conversation, the result of which was the amendment I introduced today. I have a document that I just talked with Mr. McLeod, who is somewhere here. Oh, there you are. Hi. I have a document that I'll be sharing, just some additional tweaks, incorporating some language you provided, providing some suggestions for synonyms to wanton been reckless or intentional that we can all agree on. And it seems like the difference between like breaking the system and having a workable bill is just getting those two tweaks right. So I'm optimistic that we can come together.
Very good. Thank you.
And I'm so sorry, Mr. Chair, we're meeting again on Friday, so hopefully imminently. I think this process helped make sure that everyone could come together and really have robust conversations on the timeline that is necessary to address this issue.
Thank you, Representative Feist, and thank you for the commitment to continue working on this bill. I know we have another stop going to, so I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3483 as amended to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and House File 3483 as amended is re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you for being here. Thank you all who are testifying today on the bill.
I had a really exciting closing speech. So I just have to imagine.
Okay. Next item that we have on the agenda is House File 3712 from Representative Hicks. If you'd like to come down to the testifier table.
Remind folks as they're moving.
Yeah, and as people are moving out, if you could hold it down so that we can continue on. I do know that this bill here 3712 also has a number of testifiers, so we will be limiting testimony on that part of the on this bill also when we get to it. Representative Hicks, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move my bill, but I also have an author's 1A amendment.
Okay. Representative Hicks moves to re-refer House File 3712 to the Human Services Finance Committee, and you have an A1 author's amendment. If you'd like to move it and explain it, please.
Yes. I move to approve the A1 author's amendment. The amendment adjusts the makeup of the proposed task force to ensure that provider representation is not overpowering the representation of people accessing the service, and adjust the timeline of the task force to for appointments and first meeting to ensure the department has time to implement it.
Okay. Thank you. Members, are there any questions or comments on the author's A1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the author's A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion is approved and House File 3712 is amended. Representative Hicks, to your bill.
Thank you so much. In front of you today is House File 3712, which looks to delay the implementation of adult family foster care rate tiers and creates a task force to study these proposed tiers and the impact the changes would have on the individuals currently living in the service. We last session passed legislation that removes this service from the waiver rate system and establishes flat tier rates for the service effective 2026. As these are being looked at by providers, there's growing concerns about what they may mean for the future of the service. This bill does not change what we did, but it delays the implementation till 2028, giving more time for a task force that involves providers, individuals receiving the service, and the department to look at the rates and make any necessary recommendations. With that, I will look to my testifier to give more detailed information.
Okay. Very good. Before I start with the testifiers, I'd like to remind testifiers that we have 2 minutes each, and also want to let the committee know that we had a number of people submit letters to us that are in your packet. Please make sure to review those. And with that, we will start with Sarah Brastrom. If you'd like, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. And I will take like 75% of my testimony and slash it and speak off the cuff a little to meet that 2 minutes. So for the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom and I am the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. Representative Hicks already did a really great job of kind of explaining what was passed last session. So I'll just hop into some of our concerns with the flat tiers as passed and what we're hoping to accomplish with this legislation. So as you know, our family foster care provider members have many concerns with these proposed rate tiers. First, there's an uncertainty as to what an individual's new rate will be. The rate tiers that have been published were based on data from 2017. These will need to be revised before final rates are published. And the revised rate tiers are based on MnChoices 2.0, which continues to be delayed, further delaying the release of the final family foster care rate tiers. Because rates are not final, widespread notification of the changes have not been made to family foster care providers across the state. With a proposed effective date of January 1, 2026 for the new rates, it's troublesome to not have the data that those rates will be based upon and to know that many providers are not aware of this change coming their way. ARM has reviewed the current proposed rates using the 2017 data, and initial modeling of those rates shows drastic rate reductions for some family foster care providers, resulting in many providers considering shutting their doors and no longer providing this important service. With over 1,200 family residential providers in our state, the loss of even a few represents a major loss to the network of providers who do this work. So as Representative Hicks said, we are proposing to delay the effective date of these rates, pushing it back to 2028, allowing family foster care rates to remain in the disability waiver rate system until that time, and also proposing a task force to really look at what is being proposed, study it with providers around the table. I saw you hit your phone, Nick, to tell me time is up. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being so prompt on your time there. Next testifier we have is Jason Steck. If you'd like to come forward, please. And after Jason Steck, we have Angela Strasser. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jason Steck, and I represent a organization that was formed actually just yesterday in the Minnesota Association of Residential Services Homes. And I want to take a few seconds to identify what MARSH is. MARSH is an association of small, often home-based providers of family residential services and adult foster care services and home community-based services. And MARSH members are particularly alarmed by some recent proposals, including the one that we're addressing here today for the tiered reimbursement rates, but also some other policies that have been imposed by DHS, all of which they feel could make operation of their family residential services businesses flatly impossible. My role here today is mostly just to offer information from the perspective of these small FRS providers. As small providers, these family and home-based businesses are particularly vulnerable to proposals like reductions in their reimbursement rates. Adult foster care providers, as the committee knows, is limited to 4 people in their homes, and it's a 24/7 job, meaning that if the reimbursement rates are cut, they simply can't operate anymore. They'll go away. They will simply disappear. They can't do the job, especially since they can't supplement it with other income. They're a 24/7 job. So the concern that MARSH members have is simply that the new reimbursement rates would make this industry go away almost entirely, because the adult foster care providers would simply disappear, as it would be economically unviable for them to exist. So the MARSH members are pleased to see the formation of the task force, and they're looking forward to contributing to the process. Now, I'd also like to, I come here today to introduce the next people who are the MARSH board members, and that is Sandra Donahue and Angela Strasser.
Okay. Thank you so much for your testimony. Next person then we will be going to will be Angela Strasser, if you'd like to come down. And then after Angela will be Sandra Donahue, if you'd like to be ready. Thank you for taking the time to be here this afternoon. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Fisher and members of the Human Service Committee, thank you for allowing me to have the opportunity on behalf of the individuals we support and all family residential service providers. My name is Angela Strasser. I, too, am a current ARM member, and we appreciate the work they are doing. Please refer to my written testimony that I've already submitted. We have been told over and over we are not a business initiative, yet we are held to the same 245D compliance rules and regulations. The statement, we are doing this out of the kindness of our heart, is inaccurate. Are we passionate? Absolutely. However, we must make a livable wage as we work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Small providers such as I are the most vulnerable. We do not have endless financial resources to be supported. Sometimes we are not viewed as a necessity. If the new tiered system is not reevaluated and providers are forced to accept the rates that were passed, 70% of all family residential service providers will close their door. In calculation, this is approximately 3,300 individuals that we currently support. Is Minnesota ready to take that on? Where will the individuals we support go? If they are lucky enough to find placement, who will support them? Will these supports be person-centered? Will their culture be recognized and honored? Every individual has their own culture, which must be identified and supported, because it takes dedicated support staff who are committed to building relationships with each individual to identify what their culture means to them. It takes many years to build trust and to build relationships. Family residential service providers are the trust and stability. In 2017, we were faced with a direct care workforce shortage. The Olmstead subcabinet told DHS and the Department of Employment and Economic Development to form a multi-agency work group, in which they did. Their number one priority was increase worker wage and her benefits. The strategies within that was livable wage. If you look at the governor's budget, the flat tier is not a livable wage. It offers the highest tier that's proposed, $12.66 an hour. So what I want to say is, now I'm getting short on time. Yesterday we did form the Minnesota Association of Residential Service Homes, and with that, we would like to have a seat at the table. We would like to be part of the task force and be considered for both adult foster care and home and community-based services. So on behalf of the individuals that we support and all community family residential service providers, thank you for the time, and we appreciate the support.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. Next, Sandra Donahue, if you'd like to come down, please. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Sandra Donahue. I have been a provider for over 20 years. I appreciate the delay of to 2028 for the flat rate system and the proposal to create the advisory task force, but I do not support the flat rate at all. In 2020, DHS wrote a legislative report on family providers and the DWRS rate system. They said we are unique. We are. I agree with that. We provide the same services as corporate settings. However, we also provide an extended family to those we support and to their families. We become their family. We are unique, but we shouldn't be penalized because we provide those services in our homes. The report addressed costs that make us different. I challenge that. Like corporate settings, we have the same rules. We have the same mental and physical health challenges in the people that we support. We have the same need of hiring supplemental staff for one-on-one programming and awake staff written in their individual support plans. We must abide by those rules. We are different in that. We alone provide the daily care for the people we support. We alone do all of the administrative paperwork for compliancy. Hiring supplemental staff is not supported in the current rate system, let alone the flat rate system, without exceptions, that has been delayed to 2028. In my written testimony, I wrote that 70% of us will close because we will not be able to meet the needs of the people we support. Are you prepared for placing the displaced population, knowing of the staff shortages that are addressed in DHS partner and provider's website? Are you prepared for the trauma that will be inflicted on the people that we support as they are removed by the state of Minnesota and put into other placements? Can you figure out where you need to go? I am a member of ARM and I appreciate everything that ARM does, but we need representation on this task force as Marsh. It is imperative that our voices are heard because the people we support have too much to lose without it. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be here, and thank you for your testimony. With that, I'll move on to questions and comments from members. Not seeing any. With that, Representative Hicks, any closing comments? And then please renew your motion.
Thank you. I will skip closing comments because I know we're short and we have more bills. So I renew my motion to refer to the Human Services Finance Committee. I knew where we were going. Okay.
Representative Hicks moves to re-refer House File 3712 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the bill is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee as amended. Thank you for the bill. Next, we have Representative Coran, House File 3939. Representative Coran, if you'd like to come down to the testifier table and move your bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move to re-refer House File 3939 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Thank you, Representative Coran. I believe you also have an author's amendment. If you'd like to please move that.
I do. We have a DE amendment. This reflects changes needed based on technical assistance received by the Department of Human Services. And so with that, I move the DE1 author's amendment to House File 3939 to get the bill in the shape that I prefer.
All right. Thank you, members. Any discussion to the DE author's amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the DE1 author's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the DE1 author's amendment is adopted. Back to House File 3939 as amended. Representative Coran, if you'd like to please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. In front of you today, we have House File 3939. This is a bill brought forward by ARM, which we know is the Statewide Trade Association of Residential Service Providers. This bill provides a time-limited license conversion opportunity for a small group of homes currently licensed as SLFs, or supportive living facilities, to convert to a CRS, or a community residential setting. This exception would be put in place until June 30th, 2026, and would impact a total of 14 homes across the state. So this is a very, very targeted, very specific bill for these homes. Here to provide more detail on this request for an exception and the need for it is Ken Bentz with ARM.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We will start with then Mr. Ken Bentz. Try to keep it 2 minutes, please, as we've got several other bills to get to today. So thank you for taking the time to be here. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. As stated, my name is Ken Bentz. I'm the Director of Research Analysis and Policy at ARM. And we're talking about House File 3939, which, as Representative Curran said, addresses a pretty unique and uncommon situation. So most commonly, people who are on disability waivers live in what's known as a community residential setting, or a CRS, usually a group home, usually at about 4 beds capacity. For somebody who's not on a waiver, they could also choose to live in what's called an intermediate care facility, or an ICF. And these can range in size from small to much larger than CRS settings. And these ICFs are classified as supervised living facilities, or SLFs, and they are duly licensed by both the Departments of Human Services and the Department of Health. Well, this bill doesn't deal with either of those types of situations. This unique situation applies to SLFs, supervised living facilities, that are not ICFs. They have a maximum license capacity of 6, and they're supporting individuals that are on one of the disability waivers, and they are receiving community residential services in these SLF settings. These homes are required to maintain dual licensures, though, with both, again, the Departments of Health and the Department of Human Services. And while they support people that access one of the waivers, providers have recently been informed that individuals on the CADI waiver cannot live in an SLF. And as Representative Curran said, there are 14 of these facilities around the state. So this amended proposal that we've submitted will allow for a time-limited license conversion, allowing these homes to permanently convert from an SLF to a CRS and permanently maintain their current license capacity. By allowing this, the individuals that live in these homes will have access to things like assistive technology or remote support, can also have alone time, and both of these things are not permitted currently in these homes as they're classified as SLFs. And then also will reduce the administrative complexity of having to be dual licensed by both departments. So we're not proposing any change in capacity. We're simply proposing a change in the licensure. And so with that, I'm done and can answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bentz. Next on the agenda for testifiers is Jason Steck. If Jason would like to come down. Welcome back to the committee. please introduce yourself. Begin your testimony. You've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I've said, I'm Jason Steck, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Residential Service Homes. We really only have on this bill a concern that we just want to raise for the committee, and that's from the perspective of small family residential services providers. There's a concern that despite the fact that this applies only to a currently applies to only a small range of corporate homes, it could lead to a situation where the corporate homes, it could expand. It could create a situation where the corporate homes get to open these satellite locations with small numbers and essentially directly compete against the small providers with the advantage of all the advantages that come to a corporate. Now, we don't know exactly, and we haven't been able to look at this closely enough to know how significant this concern is, but we wanted to raise the issue for the committee.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Appreciate the testimony raising the issue for us. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone. Members, any comments or questions? Not seeing any Representative Keel, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify. So this would eliminate the needs for licensure from both the MDH and the DHS. So it would be a reduction.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Lead Kill. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And the fiscal note for this is coming?
Representative Curran, do you know if that's been requested yet?
As far as I'm aware, there should be no fiscal impact with this. It's just policy only.
But it is being referred to the Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. So if there's okay. Something that comes up, we'll be addressing it there. Representative Keel.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it.
All right. Not seeing anyone else. Representative Curran, any closing comments? And then please renew your motion.
Sure. Closing comments. Please support the bill. And I will renew my motion that House File 3939 as amended be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Curran moves to re-refer House File 3939 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion prevails and House File 3939 as amended is re-referred to Human Services Finance Committee. Our next bill is another Curran bill. Representative Curran, this is House File 3940. Would you like to please move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move to refer House File 3940 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Curran moves to re-refer House File 3940 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Would you like to introduce your bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair. We have today House File 3940, which proposes to standardize the approval process for assistive technology across the state and include the costs used to provide direct care through assistive technology to what is counted in direct care compensation thresholds in the DWRS or disability waiver rate system. We as a state have put in place policy statements stating that all adults and children with disabilities can use assistive technology and remote supports, and that all individuals have the right to make an informed choice about the use of assistive technology and remote supports. The language that we're proposing to add to the implementation of this policy, of these policy statements, will ensure that no barriers will be put in place outside of what the state requires for approval of assistive technology and remote supports. The language will also implement a timeline for the approval or denial of technology and requires formal notification as to why the technology is being approved or denied. Finally, we're adding the costs associated with providing direct care through assistive technology and remote supports to the allowable costs for the new direct care compensation thresholds that were put in place by this legislature in 2023. I want to mention that we are in conversations with both the state and counties on the best way to move this bill forward. And with me today is Elena Gallagher with ARM to provide further detail.
Awesome, thank you. Elena Gallagher, welcome to the table. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Elena Gallagher, and I'm the Executive Project Manager with ARM, specifically overseeing our innovation grant, which focuses on assistive technology and remote support. ARM is a trade association of residential service providers, providing services through the four disability waivers and supporting people in a variety of different living environments, from a four-person community residential setting to an individual's own home. The bill in front of you proposes changes to the informed choice and technology provisions for the four disability waivers and provides for a uniform standard in the implementation of assistive technology for people with disabilities. I will walk through the bill and I'm happy to stand for questions at the end. Beginning with Section 1, we are proposing additional language to make clear the standard for approval of assistive technology and its implementation. Throughout this last year, ARM staff have been going around the state, providing training to lead agencies on the different assistive technology and remote support options that are available to people with disabilities. We have found during these trainings that different lead agencies have different standards for approval. Our proposal would clarify that lead agencies are not to include any additional processes or requirements outside of those already set by the state, which may further hinder the approval and implementation of assistive technology. In addition, lead agencies must follow a set approval timeline of no more than 30 calendar days to approve or deny a request. It is also noted that if a request is denied, the lead agency has to give clear reasoning for the denial, addressing why they believe the technology request does not meet an individual's assessed need. We are witnessing many instances wherein lead agencies establish their own regulations, leading to significant challenges. For instance, some lead agencies have mandated assistive technology assessments for all technology requirements. However, this is not a requirement by the state and poses a substantial bottleneck, particularly in Minnesota, where few agencies offer such assessments, resulting in extensive scheduling delays. Currently, assessments are being scheduled into June and July, for example. It's important to note that these assessments are not mandated again by the Department of Health and Human Services. The imposition of such a requirement by lead agencies creates obstacles in promptly providing individuals with crucial assistive technology to address their needs as soon as requests are made. Section 2 of the bill makes modifications to the direct care compensation thresholds that are set by the legislature last session. The new compensation threshold rules requires that 66% of the revenue generated by Medicaid rates be used for direct care compensation, primarily wages and benefits. Our proposal will add two additional items to the list of permissible costs that may count towards the 66% threshold, including the costs paid to remote monitoring contractors and the costs associated with the technology itself to support an individual remotely. An example I use when describing the issue is overnight staffing. If you have a sleep overnight staff at a home, the compensation you pay to that staff would count towards the 66% threshold. You need to meet as a provider. However, if individuals to use alternative overnight supervision through technology for their overnight services, the compensation threshold for that technology and the provider providing that overnight remote support does not count towards that 66%. This creates a disincentive to promote technology and makes it challenging for providers to meet the requirement laid out in statute while supporting individuals who are utilizing different kinds of assistive technology or remote support. ARM has long been a champion for the use of assistive technology in services for people with disabilities. Remote supports and assistive technology have helped homes remain open where, due to the staffing shortage, they may have been in danger of closure. These options have supported increased independence, and as a result, reliance on caregivers has lessened. With this bill, we are looking to level the playing field, making sure there are no winners and losers depending on where you live, and remove any potential disincentives in moving forward with assistive technology. Mr. Chair, that is a summary of the changes we are proposing, and again, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you so much for taking the time to explain the bill and be here today. With that, I will open up to questions, and the first person I have is Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, wow. Representative Hicks, you can take it easy.
It's an exciting bill. Thank you so much for this bill. I do have a question, though. So this goes bigger than your assistive technology. What if, outside of the box thought, what if we had a bill that said lead agencies don't include additional processes or requirements
in addition to those required by the commissioner, that would delay or approve implementation of services? What if we just went really, like, big and made sure that people got all their services in a timely manner in alignment with statute? What do you think about that, Representative?
I'll go to Representative Curran first. It's possible your testimony might like to add on to that, so we'll start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Hicks. That is something that I'd be happy to work on with you. You know, this one I know is specifically focused on technology, and a big chunk of that is because of the cost piece and incorporating the cost of technology when it comes to direct care compensation. But in general, when we're talking about delaying service implementation, I would be happy to work on that with you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gallagher, would you like to add any comments?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. I would say that's absolutely a wonderful dream and something that I think is certainly worth moving forward with. I think one of the things with consideration specifically with assistive technology and remote support is that it really can help with some of those other services that we're seeing delayed. So a lot of times people are thinking first and foremost of setting up staffing for somebody who needs assistance rather than thinking of technology or remote support first. And currently with staffing shortages and staffing delays, it's so hard to find the appropriate staff that sometimes that's what's resulting in the delay of them making a decision or putting forward those service authorizations. There can also be a lot of times back and forth. Maybe a provider thinks they have an opening and then that's filled or isn't available anymore, or complications due to that person's needs arise. So I think that's why we specifically focused this one on the assistive technology and remote support, seeing it as a means of helping with some of the other larger issues. But I certainly, I'm all for an idea of getting those approvals to move faster.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hicks, and then I know we have Representative Keel.
That's all. Just given the continuous improvement study and some of the conversations we're having about the barriers that people are experiencing, I think the idea that we would follow statute and not delay services sounds like a really good plan.
Good. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, does DHS support this bill?
Representative Curran, or do we have somebody from DHS? We've got Director Grom who is here.
No, I heard. I heard rumor that it was Director Grom's birthday yesterday.
Oh yes! Happy belated birthday! But no singing today. And I do realize that the governor's budget's not out yet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Christy Grom with the department. That's right. The governor's budget is not out yet. We have looked at this bill, and I would say we're neutral. But in general, we do really support the use of assistive technology. We do have a policy proposal this year that does something similar. We do have some concerns about the second section of the bill around diluting the direct support professional wages. So we'll continue to have conversations with ARM about that.
Okay, very good. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be, you and I have talked about some of the concerns with direct care and technology. It's not that it's bad, it's just not as available as we'd like sometimes. And it really hinders care for people, individuals. So thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Knorr?
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. I just wanted to ask, how the artificial intelligence will play into this remote systems, because we've been talking about it recently. We Good. Don't have any guardrails, but I think we can discuss that later as we try to form how to make sure that AIs, how they're used in many of the human services area. Yeah.
No, good point. Thank you for raising that. That's something that we'll have to keep in mind as we're going forward with these bills. And I know these will be coming to your committee also. And appreciate your knowledge that you have in the technology sector that will help guide us as we go forward.
Mr. Chair, can
yes,
I ask?
Yes, Representative Keel.
Thank you. I know we need to move, but I'm wondering, with County Social Services, have we heard from them at all about do they support the bill or do they have concerns? Nobody is here.
I see somebody, a representative from the counties, if we could have them come down.
Thank you.
And then if we could be brief, and then I know we've got our next bill that will queue up then. Thank you for coming down. Please introduce yourself, and you can then respond to Representative Keel's question.
Matthew Freeman, the Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and my birthday is the end of April.
Oh, good to know it.
Counties have been in touch with the author on the bill. We do have some concerns that we're working through regarding language on the requirements to counties. We haven't had a chance to engage that in great detail with the author and the advocates on this. I believe that we're meeting with them Friday or later this week to go into more detail about what amendments or concerns we would have about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. And with that, Representative Karam, we'll go back to you for closing comments and then for you to renew your motion.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you to our testifier and for folks that were able to come up and answer some questions from the committee. I really appreciate that. And thank you, members, for the robust discussion. Of course, we are continuing conversations with stakeholders on this and happy to work on any amendments that will make this feasible for everyone involved. With that, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 3940 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Representative Cran moves to re-refer House File 3940 to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and House File 3940 is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you for the bill. Thank you to the testifiers that were here. And then we are on to our final bill for the day, and that is House File 3907, Representative Vernig. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today. Seeing you are not on the committee, and I will move to have House File 3907 be re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. And Representative Vernig, if you'd like to explain your bill, and then I understand you have a couple of testifiers that we'll go to.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. In front of you today is House File 3907, a bill brought forth by ARM, the Trade Association of Residential Service Providers, supporting people with disabilities across the state. This bill would appropriate $2.5 million in fiscal year and $2.5 million in fiscal year 2026 for grants to providers to build capacity and services and support individuals in their goals to transition from provider-controlled congregate settings to living in their own homes. As providers continue to support people in their housing goals, these grant dollars would help filling gaps when waiting for services to be authorized, provide resources for providers to be innovative and build out the services they provide, as well as incentivize providers to support people in non-congregate settings. I would like to yield to my testifiers.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Vernig, for explaining the bill. First testifier I have is Johnny Tevet. Thank you. If you'd like to introduce yourself, welcome to the committee, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Johnny Tevet. I'm the Policy and Engagement Manager for ARM. For the interest of time, I'll make my remarks brief, as my colleague Sarah Grafstrom did. So talk about birthdays. I'm happy to do that in the hallway after. The bill in front of you today is seeking a one-time grant to incentivize providers to support individuals in moving out of group living settings and into one's own individual home. The grant would be in the amount of $2.5 million in fiscal year 2025 and the same amount in fiscal year 2026, appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Human Services. The grant would be allowable on expenses which enhance resources and staffing support for people moving into an independent living situation to better understand their housing options, to provide resources for housing expenses related to moving, and the implementation and testing of innovative approaches to better support people with disabilities and their families in living in their own independent space. As ARM works with over 160 member organizations supporting individuals in a variety of living settings, we find more and more that independent living spaces are needed for folks moving out of congregate living settings. The issue they run into often comes in the form of logistics and understanding of options. How will someone move into their own home and tackle both the person, tackle accessibility and service options? How can we find the best housing option which makes sense for both the person seeking the house and their family? And how can we further develop a standard in making this transition smoother across the state? We believe that this one-time grant could set the standard and provide a playbook for individuals moving forward in this critical transition. While the particular grant would end by 2027, our hope is that we would take these learnings and services developed with these dollars and replicate them across the state thereafter. Our members are partners in supporting people to live wherever they choose, and this would go a long way in doing so. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Stacy Rowe. If you'd like to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Stacy Rowe. I am Board of Directors President at ARM, and I also work for Mainsail Services, a home and community-based services provider. And I am here today in support of House File 3907 on what appears to be ARM Bill Day today. So back in 2020, legislation was passed and Minnesota adopted an independent living first policy, which states each adult Minnesotan with a disability be offered the opportunity to live as independently as possible before being offered supports and services in a provider-controlled setting. As with any systemic change in how and where people are supported, many providers will need to innovate and resource differently in order to honor this policy. This will take time and money that currently some providers just can't afford, and even those who can, it just takes a lot of resource to shift the way that you do business. So as we do the work to explore with people where and with whom they want to live, when they do identify that they want to move from congregate care to their own home, multiple actions need to be taken. And there are currently some services and supports in place to work with people during these times of discovery and transition. But as you can see by the pace of change, more resourcing is needed within the provider network. By accessing grant dollars, providers can take actions such as enhancing their internal staffing knowledge and capacity regarding own home supports, and then supporting people and their families in understanding and making transitions from congregate care to own home living. Grants, as you know, are a very important tool that can help move us to truly being an independent living first state, and I appreciate your consideration of this bill. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, are there any other testifiers that are here today who would like to come forward and speak? Not seeing any at this point in time, we'll go to any questions from members or comments from members. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I can appreciate the being in congregate care and then deciding to move independently. But my experience is that usually isn't the wisest move for people, and it might be a choice, but I'm wondering, when we're starting a new grant program, or this is what this is talking about, do we know how many FTEs would be required to set this up, full-time equivalents?
Representative Bernig.
Sorry. Can I phone a friend and have a testifier come and tell me about how many FTEs you would need to stand up this grant?
If you'd like to reintroduce yourself.
Johnny Tevet, Policy and Engagement Manager with ARM. At this time, we don't have a direct number on FTEs that would be required to stand this up.
Okay. And Representative Keel, are you talking about FTEs from?
From the department that would be managing it, yes. Okay. So do we?
And I don't think we would have that. I think that would be part of the fiscal note that would come. I do understand that it's been requested, but Chair Knorr, I take it that would be coming up in your committee then with the fiscal note. Chair Knorr?
Yes, Mr. Chair. When we get the fiscal note, it's going to indicate the FTEs required. So we're waiting to receive the fiscal note from the department.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Keel.
So thank you, Madam Sir Chair.
It's all right.
Mr. Chair. Good grief. Been a long day already. I guess I'm a little concerned about this commitment, actually, for next session, because that's where this is going to be, not this session. And being able to set it up with the department concerns me. And I have real concerns about even moving people from congregate to individual. But like I said, I appreciate that. However, in our effort to help people be in their own homes or independent. Sometimes that's not advisable, even though that's what they want. I just moved my parents, and my dad did not want to be moved. But if you called him today, after 6 months, he'd tell you that this was the best move he could have made because it gave them independence, but also gave them the supports they need. And when we're talking about people that need those support systems, I often wonder if it isn't a saving either. Because it's costly to set up homes to have the requirement. And I don't see this as being terribly feasible in rural Minnesota. So just comments, but something I think we need to think about as we move forward, because it's great to be everything to everyone, but it isn't possible. And we have to think about how we're caring for people. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. First, Representative Vernig, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Welcome to the legislature and welcome to this committee for the first time. Glad to see you here. Just a couple of things. So one of the reasons that I really appreciate this bill and sort of thinking ahead is what we're going to do about this problem. As some of you know, I worked in the nonprofit provider realm for 20 years. Before coming to the legislature. And we saw this as a significant barrier for folks who were trying to change their living situation, whether that was, going to a different provider or in oftentimes folks looking for a more independent setting. And so that is a real problem. And I just I just want to make a note, too, that there absolutely is a population of folks where moving from a congregate living space to an independent space is appropriate, and for so many reasons. Now, I can acknowledge that it might be less appropriate for someone to move to an individualized living situation if they are in mental or physical health decline, and we know that, and that person might require further care as time goes on. Sure, maybe an independent setting may not be the best for them. But I think what sometimes gets missed here is we're not just talking about folks who might be elderly. We're talking about people with developmental disabilities. This could include a 25-year-old woman who is learning to do the things necessary daily to provide for herself, pay her own bills, get herself transported around town. I've seen this happen with support of group home and group home staff to a point where people have been successful in their goal of living independently. And that's what I think we're here to lift up and see more of and remove the barrier from that happening. So just wanted to address that point that I understand that there's an idea that congregate living is a safer space for people with disabilities. But as I mentioned Monday during a different bill, we need to recognize where we're at now when it comes to how we treat folks with disabilities and folks receiving services like this, that when we try to put people in a bubble and, continually add more and more protection so that we feel comfortable, that is actually taking dignity away from that individual. So I want to clear that up, that congregate living, while appropriate for many, for many, this is a transition space that allows them to become independent. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Curran. Next, I have Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. I agree with everything that my colleague just said. And I also want to sort of call out the fact that we have a moratorium on group homes and on cognitive settings. And so it's important that we're using those spaces for the folks that need that level of support. And for people who maybe don't need that level of support anymore because they've learned skills, because they want to try other things, it's important that we have ways for them to do that. And that's what this bill does, and I'm really grateful that you brought it and that we can have that conversation and that people can have conversations with their support network about what makes sense for them and have resources to try, which is great. Dignity and risk is really important. And if we're going to become an inclusive state where all people of all abilities have the ability to choose where they live,
then we have to give the resources to make that happen. And so this is a wonderful first step, and I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hick. With that, I will go back to Representative Vernick for closing comments.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you guys could have done my closing for me, so thank you. I appreciate your consideration of House File 3709, as these one-time funds are a great way to support providers to provide capacity as they support individuals in their transition from provider-controlled congregate settings to living on in their own homes independently. So thank you.
Very good. With that, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 3907 to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. The motion prevails, and House File 3907 is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Vernick, for the bill. Our next hearing will be on Monday, March 4th, and we'll be hearing bills from Representative Edelson, Coran, and Chair Pryor. Seeing there's no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.